Hello. In this audio snippet, we would like to continue talking about betrayal. That's the theme that continues to reverberate in the atmosphere this week. We wanted to continue talking about music and so forth, but for some reason, it seems like betrayal is the topic. It's in the air, and that's what needs to be talked about. That's what the truth needs or wants to say to us. There is betrayal. The topic of betrayal is in the atmosphere. But before we get into that, we'd like to make a sort of clarification, even though I'm afraid I might end up creating more confusion than clarification. But it's one little thing that was in my heart and mind after the last recording, where we talked about greenness and not being willing to compromise, and that is an essential quality of being green, as we have defined greenness before. But having said that, it's important to also know that that being green doesn't mean that you will never be in an environment that is compromised. And that sounds like a contradiction, but so it is difficult to discern. But there is a kind of a complex situation where we may be, even if we have a green disposition, or we are in the green stage, as we've called it, and we have no compromise in our hearts, that doesn't mean that we will reject everything that has compromise, that everything that where the environment is compromised in some way. And the reason why I'm trying to say this is that if we got very strict about, okay, I'm not going to deal with anything, if there is any sort of compromise associated to it, then we would practically have to leave the world, because the world is compromised. We are in an environment that is inherently compromised. So if we wanted to be in a situation where there is absolutely no compromise, then we'd have to, you know, kill ourselves. That would be the only way out. And yes, in a certain sense, the green person is willing to die rather than compromise. So therefore, what I'm about to say seems like a contradiction, but I hope that that if there is truth in what I'm saying, that it will be evident or in some way to you if you're listening to this, that sometimes you can have a green, uncompromising heart and attitude and still be called to be in the midst of a situation where there is compromise in the air, in the environment. But the thing is, even if you're in that environment, you're not contaminated by that attitude of compromise. You don't assimilate and embrace the compromise, but sometimes you are called to be in a situation of compromise. And the thing is, what I found in my personal experience is that eventually, if you're in a situation of compromise and the compromise becomes so compromised that it just becomes unbearable. There's a point where you go, you will be forced to leave the environment. It's like things will come to a head, and there will be a moment where you'll have to decide, okay, I have to leave, and then you leave. Or things will, a series of events will happen that will make it known that, okay, you were in this situation of compromise for a season, but it's time to move on. And sometimes things stay the same, and you know you're supposed to be there for a while longer. But I wanted to clarify that, because I to avoid the simplified thinking that if you are green, then you will never do anything where there is any sort of impurity or compromise, because that would not only be impractical, but it would be sort of a distortion of what that attitude of non-compromise is. But having said that, it doesn't mean that you are going to embrace any sort of compromise in the environment. But you are there for a season and a reason. And when the season and the reason run out, you will, if you are uncompromising in your heart, you will know about it. It's like you will know it's time to go, or it's time to leave that situation and move somewhere else. And in a certain sense, that in a larger sense, that's kind of what has happened to me personally with America. You know, being in America and being in this environment, this that was compromised, profoundly compromised, not only on the left but on the right, you know, liberals and conservatives. You know, just everything was just deeply compromised. But there was a season and a reason to continue, you know, being in the midst of this environment and hoping and fighting for the change. But the time came when it was over. The compromise just became so overwhelming that the environment just became untenable. And the situation became untenable, and therefore it's time to move on. And that's what I hope to do if I don't, if something doesn't happen to me first, hopefully I will be able to leave and go somewhere else. But so that's a side comment before talking about some of the things that have been kind of percolating all of this week, and it's all related to betrayal. So the first thing that we wanted to talk about is some very interesting confirmations that were kind of like presented before me in this very kind of explicit, overt way. I don't know how to say it. It's like put in my face, like, here, look at this. One of the confirmations happened the very next day after the last recording. So the last recording was done, you know, obviously last week, on December 16th, 2023. And that was a Saturday. The next day was a Sunday, and we are in football, American football season here in the U.S. So they play NFL games all over the country on Sunday, and a lot of people spend their time on Sundays watching these games. As I've shared before, I don't watch them anymore. I used to be a very devoted NFL fan for years, but as a famous singer would say, the thrill is gone. So I couldn't care less anymore. But for some reason, I am following two teams, but not following them in the sense of like a fan trying to know how they're doing and cheering for them or so forth. But I have been trying to follow from a distance how the New York Jets and the New York Giants have been doing, and I've been cursing them, especially the New York Jets. I've been cursing the New York Jets for years now. It all started some years ago when they had a player called Tim Tebow, a quarterback that a coach called Rex Ryan, and Ryan sounds like an Irish name to me, by the way, so it kind of fits in with the theme of betrayal. So they brought in this this quarterback who was known around the league for being a very devoted Christian, and that's why he was always attacked. And he was a very good player, but he was never really given a chance. They kept criticizing his statistics and stuff, but without going into too many details, when he was used and allowed to play, he was able to, he showed that he was a winner, that he could do these miraculous comebacks and win because there was something about him. There was something like, there was a greatness in him just waiting to be manifested, if it was allowed to be manifested, but they kept constraining him, and the media were always very critical of him because he had the gall to kneel down in a silent way to thank his God after scoring or after a play. And that was like, oh, how dare he do that? And it's so ironic that a few years later, the same media who were criticizing this one guy for just showing silently his faith in his God, that the same media was praising all these morons who were kneeling during the national anthem. So you see the hypocrisy there. But the thing is that they brought in this guy, Tim Tebow, to New York, and there was excitement in the air. And I was hopeful that they would let him play and that he would bring back the New York Jets to the glory days of the late 60s very early 70s. The New York Jets last won a Super Bowl in 1968. Super Bowl III, I think it was 68, December of 68, they beat the Baltimore Colts in a surprise victory. And they've never even been close to making it ever since. If they had allowed Tim Tebow to play, that would have brought them back to glory. I know that in my being. So they brought him in, but Rex Ryan, the coach of the Jets, he and the organization brought him in, and the intent, it became clear, was that he was supposed to be a sideshow, that they would put him in on certain plays because he would sometimes run the football. Quarterbacks tend to pass the ball, but he would sometimes run the ball and do these. So they would bring him in every now and then to do some trick plays, but then they would take him out and put in the other quarterback. And I saw that and I said, oh, they're using him. That's all they're using him as a publicity stunt and so forth because of all the attention that was on him. And eventually they, the quarterback who was the starter at the time began to struggle and struggle and struggle because it's as if there was a curse on him that, you know, it was time for him to sit down and let Tim Tebow play. And the guy just wasn't producing. He had been a very good quarterback before that, but something happened to him. But I think it was just that he was supposed to not be starting anymore and maybe would have maybe done better if he had been traded to some other team and been able to succeed in some other team, but something was going on and he just wasn't playing well. And Rex Ryan kept believing in this quarterback, oh, he's going to help us win and so forth, because he resented Tim Tebow. There's something in him that resented his Christianity or whatever it was. But he was willing to use him as a sidekick, as a sideshow, just to promote himself and the team. But he refused to put him as a starter. And usually in the NFL, if a quarterback struggles for a long time, they eventually let the backup, you know, give the backup a chance. And eventually, the poor guy was doing so badly, the quarterback, that they Rex Ryan was forced to sit him down, but instead of putting in Tim Tebow, he put in the third string quarterback. Tim Tebow was the second string, you know, the backup. But instead of putting Tim Tebow, he put in the third string quarterback, an unknown guy whose name I don't even remember today. But it was this stubbornness. Well, I'm not going to put that Christian guy in because I don't know. I want the spotlight on me. I'm using him to get the spotlight on me, but I don't want the spotlight to be on him. I don't want him to be successful. There was something in him, and there was a certain kind of like mocking attitude, like this was all a joke, and he was destroying the career of this young guy, Tim Tebow. And the other guy just was a failure. So I think he put in the starting quarterback again, the first string guy. And eventually, and I started cursing him and the Jets constantly. Eventually, the Jets were a failure. Rex Ryan was kicked out of New York. Like the moron that he was, he left in shame. And at the end of the day, they destroyed Tim Tebow's career, and eventually he had to retire. So ever since then, I said, cursed be the Jets. May they never have a quarterback who is successful. May they never have a successful team, and may their position of quarterback be cursed from this day forward until the end of time. And it's been like that ever since. They're always, you know, trying a quarterback and one after the other, and it just failure and failure and failure. And then they, at the start of the season, and by the way, I didn't know I was going to say all these things about this, but for some reason I have to go down this road. The thing is, they eventually brought in in the offseason last year, going into this year, they were able to sign a very prominent quarterback called Aaron Rodgers, and they brought him in from Green Bay. He used to be the quarterback for Green Bay, but Aaron Rodgers was another guy that I'd been cursing for years because he had been a traitor. It's too long to explain, but he showed himself to have a certain attitude, and I was supporting him. And I even supported him when the one time he made it to the Super Bowl and won. I was interceding for him the whole time, for him. And then something got into his head, like he used to be a very humble guy, and I think he was even like a Christian guy. You know, he would thank his God after winning a game and so forth, but something happened to him. I think the success got to him, and then he became a turncoat, a traitor to the faith that he used to espouse and to the God that he used to proclaim. And he started hanging out with a woman, I forget her name, and sleeping around with this model of, I forget the exact name, I forget. I'm trying to get the name back, but Olivia Munn, or I don't know. Who knows? But thing is that I could see that he turned become a traitor, and therefore I started cursing him. And he's one of the best quarterbacks ever, outstanding arm, but he would win, and then when he got to the big game, I'd start interceding against him, and cursing him, and he would always lose. You could see the frustration. He could never get over the hump again, since he's never been to the Super Bowl again. So the guy's been getting beatings for years because of the curse on him. And then eventually something happened to him. So he's now, I think he's taken his lumps, and that girl, that woman that he was with, they eventually split up and so forth. But and I think he was beginning to kind of come back from his betrayal to a certain extent, but not completely. But when I found out that he was being taken in by the New York Jets, and I apologize for talking about all this American football stuff, but there is a message here. Please bear with me. When he was signed by the New York Jets, I said to myself, oh my, and then they started talking about Super Bowl. The Jets are going to go back to the Super Bowl. And I said, oh yeah, whatever. But I was concerned. I said, well, there was this curse on the position of quarterback, and now they're bringing in this guy to kind of prove that no, there is no curse on the quarterback. We're going to bring in this guy and he's going to be successful. And I was concerned, like, okay, no, but I kept insisting the curse is on that position. The curse is on the quarterback position of the New York Jets. Then on the first game of this season, everybody celebrating and rejoicing here in the New York area that Aaron Rodgers is going to play and lead us to the Super Bowl and so forth. And I didn't know about this because I don't follow the game, but that day, the first game of the season, I found out by accident somehow that on the first, or maybe it was because I usually sometimes just turn on the games on Sundays just to see how the Jets are doing, and that maybe that's how I found out. I forget, but somehow I found out that on that first game, Aaron Rodgers started, and he was in the game for four plays. I don't know if he was four plays or he threw four passes. And then, boom, something happened. I don't know the details of the play. And he injured his Achilles heel, and he had to be dragged out of the field, dragged off the field. And then they put in his backup, and the backup has been struggling ever since. And the Achilles heel was torn. And he and Aaron Rodgers hasn't been able to play. And I said, yes, yes, thank you, thank you. The curse is still on the Jets, on the quarterback position of the Jets. And the poor guy who's been playing there, and I feel sorry for him because he's trapped in a curse. And that maybe a young guy, he doesn't realize it, but, you know, and the Jets fans have been, brutal on him. The poor guy has been struggling because, and then they replaced him and put in some other guy, and the guy's done even worse because the position is cursed. The thing is that that's why I follow the New York Jets, just to be sure that they lose constantly. Now they lost last week. They lost 30-0 to Miami, and I turned to the channel to see the score. The game had ended, and they were interviewing a guy, a Miami player, and I saw him. He was a black. I don't know what position he played, but I'm so out of touch. But he was a Miami player, and I saw his face, and I saw like a radiance out of his face. I don't know how to explain it. Like a radiance, like life coming out of his face. And I said, oh, I know what he's going to say right now. And then they put the mic on him. They asked him a question. I forget what it was. The young lady who was the reporter put the mic in his face after asking him a question. And I knew he's going to say this right now. And then she said, first of all, I want to thank the guy upstairs for this victory. And for making it possible, blah, blah, blah. I forget the details, but I said, okay, there we go. I know why there was a radiance on his face, because there was a humility in him. And he kept talking and praising his teammates and so forth. And it wasn't this fake diplomacy. You could see the sincerity in his face. And that was it. So the Jets have been struggling ever since, and I follow them. And I also follow the Giants, and they're cursed, but to a lesser degree for other reasons that are too long to explain here. So that's the only reason why I am aware of stuff in the NFL, in American football, because I'm just trying to make sure that the Jets and the Giants don't go anywhere. The two football teams in the New York area. The thing is that because of that, I turned to the NFL game, and I saw that it was there were two teams playing, and it was Houston playing Tennessee. This was on this last Sunday, December 17th. And what took me by surprise, and I said, oh my goodness, interesting, because the Tennessee Titans were wearing a certain helmet. Now, if you listen to the previous recording, I mentioned the Tennessee Titans, if I'm not mistaken, if I'm remembering correctly. I did mention it, and I remember having said, and when I said it, I felt like it was very relevant. Like as it was coming out of my mouth, there was a relevance to the words. I was saying the Tennessee Titans, who used to play for the in Houston and used to be called the Houston Oilers. I don't know if I said this in the recording or I said it when talking to someone. I don't know. For some reason, I know that I said this last week. And when I said that was very relevant. They used to be the Houston Oilers. Now they're the Tennessee Titans. And interestingly, in this game, the Tennessee Titans were wearing their old Houston Oilers helmets. And I said, wow, that was like shocking to me. And they were playing in Tennessee. And in football stadiums here in America, they usually have like the logo of the team in the middle, on the 50-yard line in the middle of the field. And they also have the logo of the team in the two end zones, you know, on each end of the field. And they had the logo of the Houston Oilers, which is, I think that it's called, I was looking, struggling to find the word, and I found it by accident. It's a derrick. It's one of those kind of things that look like a light electricity cable tower kind of thing. But it's, well, I'm sure you know what a derrick is. It's to drill oil out of the ground. To pump oil out of the ground, off the ground. But the thing is that this logo of a derrick, if that's what they're called, was in the middle of the field and on the end zones. But they were playing the Houston Texans. The Houston Texans was the expansion team that replaced the Houston Oilers after the Houston Oilers left the city and moved to Tennessee. So in America, usually the game is broadcast in the two cities where that are represented by both teams. That means that this game that was being played in Tennessee was being watched in Tennessee, obviously, on television. They black out the game, I think, if there's no sellout, but the game doesn't sell out. But the thing is that usually you see it in Tennessee in the local market where the game is being played and in the city of the other team. So this means that the game was being watched in Houston as well because the Houston Texans were playing in it. And I, when I saw that, I said, oh my goodness, pardon my French, but my reaction was, oh, worthless sons of bitches. These Tennessee Titans are worthless sons of bitches because that is so like in your face to the people of Houston. They left Houston, and usually when a team leaves a city, there's always the sense of betrayal. And that's why the theme of betrayal is, you know, in the air. This is all related. So every time, even if it's for justified reasons, when a team leaves a city, every fan in that city feels like that the team just stabbed them in the back. So they left Houston, went to Tennessee, and now that they're in Tennessee, they played this game using the Houston Oilers logo, featuring it prominently on the field. They didn't even leave the Titans logo. They changed it to the Houston Oilers logo as if to say to Houston, in your face. We used to be the Houston Oilers, but now we're playing in Tennessee, and look at us, and we're shoving it in your face that we betrayed you and left you for a better, for a more pleasant place. And by the way, I do feel that some moves are justified. I think some teams, some cities deserve to lose their teams, but that's another reason. But I don't know what the context is of why they left Houston. But regardless, the action was so uncalled for and so I'm struggling to find the word. So improper. There's another word, but it was wrong. It was definitely wrong. So I found that very interesting. And the thing is, when I turned to the game, it was 16-16, and they were in overtime. And then I had to leave. So I turned the television off and left. And found out later that the Houston Texans eventually won in overtime. And when I was watching the game, I it looked like the Tennessee Titans were advancing, and I was hoping, no, I don't want the Traitors to win. But I didn't stick around. But I thought they were going to win. I mean, that's how it looked. But it turns out that Houston won the game. And let me just go very quickly to a story that was posted on this on CBSSports.com. CBS Sports. CBS is one of the big networks here in America. And it says, the headline says, Texans, this was posted on December 18th, 2023. It's a story from the Associated Press. Texans win without Stroud, beating Titans 19-16 on Fairbairn's 54-yard field goal in overtime. And that's a pretty long field goal, by the way. Apparently they had a quarterback who got injured, and they let in this guy play, which seems fitting. I don't know why. It just seems related now that I'm thinking about it to what I was saying about Tim Tebow. And so there was the Texans had a quarterback who got injured, and because of the concussion protocol, he got injured in the head. There's a concussion protocol in the NFL that they don't let you play a guy who's experienced a potential concussion. So he had to sit out the game, and they let him. Let in this other guy play, this journeyman player called Keenum. And it says here, this was Keenum's first start since week 17 of the 2021 season for Cleveland in Ohio. And this ties in with what we're going to say later. He filled in for Stroud and shook off an early pick six, an interception for that was returned for a touchdown by Elijah Molden. And four sacks. Keenum threw for 229 yards and a touchdown. Keenum helped Houston outgain the Titan 343 to 204 yards. He also won his third straight start for Houston, counting the final two games of the 2014 season. This is the 35-year-old veteran's second stint with the Texans among the seven NFL teams in his career, and he said he's built for this. And then he said, quote, I've been in a lot of situations, unquote. Keenum said, quote, I've been in a lot of systems, been in a lot of different games, and God's made me who I am for this, for moments like this. I'm just trying to make sure that I am ready when my number's called. Like I said before, you don't have to get ready if you stay ready, unquote. And then it says here, the loss eliminated the Titans 5-9 from playoff contention, along with clinching a second straight losing record under coach Mike Vrabel, or Vrabel, however you pronounce it. So the thing is that the traitors were defeated by a guy who has this very clean heart and attitude. As you can see from the words, and he was able to win. And apparently they were losing late in the game, and he led them to on a drive to tie the game. If I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong on that. But eventually, you know, they were able to win in overtime, and with this very long field goal, 54 yards is a long field. Maybe it's not long anymore because apparently kickers, I don't know what they're drinking nowadays or eating, but they seem to be kicking longer field goals than when I used to follow the game. But it's, even so, 54 yards is a long field goal, and they were able to win. And to me, that was an example of, okay, if you give the righteous people a chance, then you can have victory and defeat the betrayer, the traitors. And that's what we had in this country, the opportunity to defeat all the traitors on both sides, the right and the left. If we had done things right, if we had given the right people, the truth seekers, the opportunity to step up and lead the country to victory. But we didn't do it, but it was like this game was this example of it can be done. And then there was another game. So I left that game. So I turned to the other channel to see if I could see if what the score was with the New York Giants. And I turned to the other channel, and then on the other channel, they had another game, and it was Cleveland against Chicago. So last time we talked about the two traitors states in the country, Tennessee and Ohio. They are the two states that epitomize betrayal in America. And Cleveland, who is, you know, a city in Ohio, they were playing against Chicago, and they were playing in Cleveland. So interesting, both games were being played in the traitor states. The other game, Houston, Tennessee, played in Tennessee. The Cleveland-Chicago game was being played in Cleveland, Ohio. And the game, this game was also tied at 17 when I turned to it. So it's interesting. I turned to one game, 16-16, they were tied. I turned to the other game, and they were tied as well, 17-17. And they had not gone into overtime. There were only 21 seconds left on the clock. And then I just tuned in time for them to see Cleveland trying a field goal. And they went ahead and scored the field goal, and they won the game. And what drew my attention for several reasons was that, so they went ahead. So then Chicago got the ball back. And they started driving down the field with only, you know, a few seconds left. And then, you know, the time eventually went down to like 5 seconds. They could only do one last play. So the Chicago quarterback took the ball, and I could see, I don't know how to explain it, there was a certain good intention in the guy. He was a black quarterback. There was a good intention in the guy, but there was weakness in him. I don't know how to explain it. There was weakness. He was well-intentioned and well-meaning, but there was weakness in him. But I was interceding for Chicago because I wanted the traitors to lose, the traitors of Ohio, Cleveland, to lose. So I started interceding for Chicago. And I said, you know, they can do it. They can do it. They can win. Even though they had to pull off this touchdown, this long touchdown pass. But it was the last play. So the quarterback from Chicago took the ball and he started running around. And then he just heaved the ball downfield, what they call a Hail Mary pass, all the way downfield towards the end zone. And then all the players in the end, everybody, like a big crowd, gathered in the end zone to catch the ball from both teams. And they leaped, they all leapt up to catch the ball. And one of the Cleveland players kind of batted the ball to the ground, trying to, you know, deflect it and so that it would drop to the ground and the game would be over. And then there was a Chicago player, number 11. That was his number. I vividly remember it. And I had watched him a few plays earlier, and I saw something very, very noble about him. But I also saw weakness. I don't know how to explain it. Just like the quarterback, noble but weak. And he was on the ground. He fell to the ground, and the ball came towards him as the Cleveland player tried to, you know, bat it to the ground. And he was, I'm very, very bad at explaining these things, but he was on the ground, and the ball came towards his chest. And as I saw that, I said, just catch it, man, just catch it. And the ball fell on his chest, and all he had to do was just hold on to it, like cradle it like a baby. And I don't know what happened. If I'd been there, I would have caught the ball. It was that that easy to just cradle. He was on the ground and the ball was coming towards his chest. All he had to do was just say, "Hey, baby, I'll take care of you," and cradle the football. But the ball got to him, and he was nervous, or I don't know what happened to him. And instead of just grabbing the ball and trusting, okay, I have it, the game is over, we've won, because if he had caught the ball in the end zone there, the game would have been a miraculous victory. But I don't know, he just, he did something very, it was easier to catch it than not to catch it. That's how what I'm trying to say. And he got, I don't know what happened to him, and he instead of grabbing the ball and cradling it, he caused it to come up in the air again. So he and then a Cleveland player in that melee just was able to grab the ball in the air and catch it for an interception, and the game was over, and Cleveland, the Traitors, won. And I said to myself, what is this? And then I turned on the TV and left. And I kept wondering, what was that? Why did that happen? And as I have been thinking about it this week, it became clear that Chicago represents, in a negative sense, we've said before on the website where these recordings are posted, and I think we've said it in these recordings, Chicago represents, it's the stronghold, the capital of the matriarchal mindset in America. Too long to explain why, but that's where the seat of the matriarchy is. That's where the capital is. Chicago is the capital of the matriarchy in America. That's why it's not a coincidence that O'Bastard came out of Chicago, rose to national relevance out of Chicago. But the thing is that, and we've said this for years, it's not like we just are trying to make it fit what's happening. No, we've been saying this for a long time, even before O'Bastard. But the thing is that Chicago represents this matriarchal mindset. And then I realized that quarterback and that receiver who almost caught the ball represent the church, the American church, that is trapped in the matriarchal mindset. Well-meaning and all that, but weak, pathetically weak. It doesn't have the character to do it. And the receiver who could have caught the ball and unfortunately didn't, his number was 11, and 11 is the number of judgment. So it was like the inability of the American church to embrace the judgment personality. Because it's always, you know, oh, you don't judge, you know, judge not lest you be judged, and all that crap that Christians in America go around saying, all this rubbish about, we love and we don't judge and we have compassion and all this rubbish. And the inability to exercise 11 judgment, to exercise the judgment personality represented by the number 11, that was what prevented the American church overcoming the wave of betrayal that has to destroy this country. That's why they weren't able to overcome the liberals because of that weakness. So the two games were this contrast of, we could have done it if we had let in the right people, let the right people play. But we didn't, and the American church in America, the Christian church, Christians, conservatives in America, were too matriarchal in their understanding, and because of that, they didn't have the strength to win. That conquering mentality. That's what I saw in these two guys. The well-meaning. I don't know. I didn't see evil. I didn't see the trashiness that I see in some players. Like I've said before, like I see them clouded, like shrouded in uncleanness in some cases. But these two guys, the Chicago quarterback and the wide receiver, they seemed like decent people. I don't know how to explain it. Like decent human beings. But the problem is there was the weakness in them, like they didn't have this thing like, I'm gonna take over and win, like I am going to conquer and overcome the enemy, and that's another male quality, you know, the conqueror personality, and because of that they lost, but it was as close as you could get to winning without winning. And I knew that I was interceding for Chicago, and I knew we can win it with this guy. This is one of the few times in my life that I intercede for Chicago. That was how desperate I was to have Ohio, the Cleveland, Ohio team lose. And it came so close, and it didn't happen. So these two games represent a betrayal, how betrayal could have been handled, and how it really was at the end of the day, and why America lost as a nation. And the other interesting thing in this game is that the quarterback for Cleveland was Joe Flacco. And Joe Flacco, I know him because when I used to follow the Ravens, the Baltimore Ravens, Joe Flacco used to play for the Ravens. He even won a Super Bowl with the Ravens. I remember interceding in that game feverishly. It was a game against San Francisco that they played in the Super Bowl against Colin Kaepernick or whatever his the hell his name is, the guy who eventually went on to lead the anthem kneeling movement in the NFL. And the thing is that Joe Flacco used to play for the Baltimore Ravens. And he even won a Super Bowl there, but something got into his head, like, oh, I'm all that. And then I started despising him, and he eventually he became a failure and had to leave Baltimore. And now I didn't know he was now playing for the Cleveland Browns. And what I found interesting is also that theme of changing teams, because Joe Flacco played for the Baltimore Ravens, and the Baltimore Ravens used to be the Cleveland Browns. The Cleveland Browns played in Cleveland for a long time until 1997, I think it was. They left the city of Cleveland, and everybody in Cleveland hated Art Modell, the owner, and the Cleveland Browns for leaving the city. So they left and moved to Baltimore and became the Ravens. That's one of the good few times I find the move healthy. When I saw them leave Cleveland and go to Baltimore, it's not that I was a Baltimore fan, because I really wasn't a big fan of the Ravens at the beginning, but I saw, oh, that's a good thing for them, because there was a staleness in Cleveland. Like, no one in Cleveland, like, there's a curse on Cleveland, and as long as they stay in Cleveland, they will never win anything. And once they left Cleveland, and they changed their name, they became the Baltimore Ravens, they changed their uniform and everything, and I said, oh, they're going to win something now. I don't know why, I just knew it. And then eventually they won two Super Bowls. Like 3 years after leaving Cleveland, they won a Super Bowl in Baltimore. They played the Giants, and they beat the Giants in Super Bowl something, I forget. The thing is that they had the change of atmosphere, and they were able to win, because Cleveland was a place of perennial failure. But the players, the people in Cleveland, hated the Ravens or the Browns for leaving and becoming the Ravens, because they felt the betrayal that always comes with when a city loses a team. But the thing is that it's interesting that Joe Flacco played for the Ravens, who used to be the Cleveland Browns. Oh, and by the way, then eventually a new Cleveland Browns team was added to the league. But it's like the same name in the same city, but it's a different franchise, if you see what I'm saying. So the Baltimore Ravens are the former Cleveland Browns, and then there's a new franchise called the Cleveland Browns that now play in Cleveland. So Joe Flacco, he became a star for the team that left Cleveland, and now he's playing for Cleveland. I don't know if I'm making sense, that this theme of teams that left one city for another and then, come back in some way. So I don't know, there was like this. So and by the way, betrayal is nothing more than changing teams, in an unfair, a very disloyal and evil way. So it all seems to fit in. So Joe Flacco is now playing for Cleveland, and he apparently had a very good game. It was part of the reason why Cleveland beat Chicago. And oddly enough, I found out, as I was looking for links related to these stories, and that's how I But as I was looking for these links, I found out by accident that tomorrow, the day after this recording, which will be December 24th, 2023, Cleveland's going to be playing Houston. So the Houston Texans. So it's like all this is interrelated somehow. It's very, very peculiar. Two of the four teams that I just mentioned are going to play each other next week. Which is, I know the odds of that, how likely is that? I know this is all related. So the Cleveland, the Cleveland Browns may have won against Chicago, but that win has come with a curse on them. They may have won that game, but it's going to serve as a curse on them going forward. So I wouldn't be surprised if they lose to Houston and they finish out the season losing out and then just fizzling out of any contention. That's what I want to say. And there's one of the links that I found related to that game between Cleveland and Chicago. Let me see if I can read it very quickly here. The Browns beat the Bears 2017, and there was something in this story that I needed to mention, but I'm not finding it. Let me see. I'm not finding it. I'm looking through this link from the Journal Star, which is apparently a Peoria, Illinois newspaper. So I'm looking at their website, and they have all the details of the game. But I wanted to see. Yeah, it says here, Chicago Bears versus Cleveland Browns game recap, Joe Flacco's late heroic stymie Bears. So the guy who used to play for the team that left Cleveland and is now back in Cleveland, he was essential in the victory. And I guess that's what I wanted to point out here. So aside from those two games, which I've taken way too long to explain because we wanted to say so many other things. Something else happened last Sunday, the day before the day after the last recording. So I went out for my walk, or maybe it was before seeing these two games. It was before knowing about these two games. I was I had the television on, and a couple of channels that I used to watch have been taken away from me. Too long to explain. They switched to a new format, broadcast format, so I can't watch them anymore. So I'm now forced to kind of look around for something else to watch. And because of that, I ended up watching this channel that I'd never watched before. And interestingly enough, they had a television, they had a special. I was taken aback when I saw it. It was a biography, shall we say, of Benedict Arnold. And I think the name of the channel is the Story Channel or something like that. Not History's Channel, but the Story Channel. The documentary was on Benedict Arnold. And I said, wow, interesting, because I don't know if this is known outside of America, but in America, if you're called a Benedict Arnold, you're basically being called a traitor. You have done some sort of betrayal, and that's the only reason why anyone would call you a Benedict Arnold. And the reason for that is that Benedict Arnold was a general in the American Revolution. He was an American, you know, obviously, fighting for the colonies against the British crown. And he was very good. As I was watching the biography, I think most of us just know of him. Oh, he was a traitor, but most people don't realize that he was a very brave general. He went into the American Revolution with gusto. He joined even when it was not yet the popular thing. He became, he enlisted and volunteered and fought very bravely. And he would go. He got injured pretty badly in one leg, because he would go out to battle and be in the front line with his soldiers. He wasn't like the general, like doing administrative work in the background. Like you guys go fight. I'm just going to supervise from behind. He would go and fight in the front lines, and he got injured in the leg pretty badly. He was sidelined. And his superiors ordered him not to fight, not to go, on the battlefield. But he said, "Hell no! I'm going to fight." and all injured, he went out and led his troops to some big victory. I forget the name of the battle. And he got reprimanded because of that, because he disobeyed his superiors. But that's how brave he was. So he was not a traitor out of cowardice, because usually that's what leads to people to betray someone or something. It's usually an act of cowardice. But in this case, he was not a coward. He was a very brave man, and very important. He led some the American army to some very relevant victories, and he was involved in the attempted invasion, the conquering of Quebec. I didn't know that America at one point tried to conquer Quebec and take it away from the British Empire, but that didn't work out. And I know there must be a reason for that, but the thing is that he eventually became very bitter, because a lot of people kept getting passed over him for promotions. So he was giving his heart and soul to the cause, and it seemed like everybody was getting ahead of him in terms of promotions, and he started resenting that. And then he eventually married a young lady who was from a very prominent family in Philadelphia, if I'm not mistaken. But they were conservative, and by conservative, you know, that meant that, you know, they were loyalists. They supported the British crown and were opposed to the American rebellion. But something happened, and he was in Philadelphia for a while, and that's how he met the girl, the lady, and he fell in love with her and married her. Many people have, you know, debated what happened to Benedict Arnold after having been such a committed, dedicated, radical, pro-revolution guy. Why did he just become just the complete opposite and betray the country? And some people say it's resentment of not being promoted, or being overlooked, or being kind of not being appreciated. But a lot of people conclude, and I would agree with them from my brief impression, that that the reason why he betrayed America was that he basically married the wrong person. So this lady who was from a family that was loyalist began to put things in his head. I'm pretty sure I can feel her whispering in his ear. I can feel her face, like next to my ear, whispering all these things, all these terrible injustices that the American army had in America have done to you. And just saying it, do you remember when they said this about you, when they did this to you? And slowly she turned his heart against America. And he ended up, you know, switching sides and fighting for the British. But the thing is, even on the other side, he was not that liked, because, you know, they didn't know if he was also going to betray them. And so he was not that liked on the British side when he switched sides. So he ended up like being a no man's land, hated by everybody. And I think he died in, I could be wrong on this, I think he died in England. On his tombstone, if I'm not mistaken, I could be making this up, but I do vaguely recall reading this or hearing that in the documentary. It says, or I don't know if it was on his tombstone or on a plaque of a house where he lived in England, and it says, "This is where Benedict Arnold is lived. Benedict Arnold, an American patriot." Which is kind of, so in Britain, he was recognized as an American patriot, even though he switched sides. So he was never British. And so he was caught in this no man's land, and obviously he was hated in America by everybody. And I went to the Wikipedia page for Benedict Arnold, and I found this very interesting thing. Let me see if I can find it here. It says here, "Arnold was aware of his reputation in his home country, and French statesmen Talleyrand described meeting him in Falmouth, Cornwall in 1794. So this is this French statesman Talleyrand talking about his encounter with Benedict Arnold. He said, he was French, so I'm going to say it with a French accent. The innkeeper at whose place I had my meals informed me that one of his lodgers was an American general. Thereupon, I expressed the desire of seeing that gentleman, and shortly after, I was introduced to him. After the usual exchange of greetings, I venture to request from him some letters of introduction to his friends in America. No, he replied, and after a few moments of silence, noticing my surprise, he added, quote, I am perhaps the only American who cannot give you letters for his own country. All the relations I had there are now broken. I must never return to the States, unquote. He dared not tell me his name. It was General Arnold. And then it says here, Talleyrand continued, quote, I must confess that I felt much pity for him, for which political Puritans will perhaps blame me, but with which I do not reproach myself, for I witnessed his agony. So that's what Talleyrand said. So he felt much pity for him. And he said, I know that people are going to criticize me for saying that, you know, I felt sorry for the guy, but I stand by that emotion, because he says he witnessed the agony of Arnold. So Arnold, it's like as his life progressed, he realized, oops, you know, I made a big mistake, and now correct this? How do I fix this mess? But it was too late. So, and that's why I don't feel just like this Frenchman. I don't feel like, oh, evil Benedict Arnold. I also feel pity, sorry for him, compassion for him. Because, see, when people repent, that's when you have to open your heart to forgiveness. And this guy obviously had lots of regrets and sorrow for what he had done, but it was too late, you know. And I think he realized that I was listening to the wrong people, and this is, I wish, what Trump would have realized, because just like this guy had, Arnold had the woman, I forget her name, and I don't even care to mention her name, his wife, you know, whispering in his ear, saying all these things, and turning his heart against America. Just like that, Trump had Ivanka and Jared whispering in his ears constantly, and he never picked up on it, never realized it. And I think he's gonna die and not ever admit that he made a mistake, that Trump is a traitor. He betrayed America and everything that he stood for, because he said, he started the betrayal very quickly. The moment he got elected, he said, I'm not going to prosecute Hillary. After he had said over and over again, if you elect me, I'm going to prosecute this woman and end the corruption and do that as a symbol of the, symbolic action against the corruption in Washington, to start an end of it, because corruption only ends until you attack it. And you prosecute it and you apply judgment to it. Otherwise, corruption is not going to go away on its own. But the moment he got elected, then he said, "Oh no!" And as we've said a million times, why did he do it? He decided, he made a deal with Hillary. You don't question the election results, and I will not prosecute you. So he made a deal behind the curtains. How do I know this? I just know it. I just know it. He made a deal with her. And that's how he betrayed the people that voted him into office. And then the betrayal just continued throughout it. And that's why he kept surrounding himself with traitors who would stab him in the back. All that he did, you know, he betrayed America and the people who supported him by endorsing and promoting Operation Warp Speed, by promoting Tony Falsey and Deborah Birx and all these people, and never doing anything against the mask mandates and all this stuff. He's a traitor. He is a traitor. And we'll talk about that later if we get to it, because we've really said taken a lot of time just to get started. So it's not a coincidence. So there were these three things: the two football games, and then this special on Benedict Arnold, as if the truth was saying betrayal is in the air. That's the topic of the day: betrayal, betrayal. And I have this feeling that's like, as if the truth were saying, America betrayed me. America betrayed me. And that's what needs to be said. That's why we're talking so much about betrayal. Then two other stories came out that seemed to confirm this whole thing about betrayal. And I'm going to go to one. It's on the dailymail.com or dailymail.co.uk as I type it. And this was posted on the 21st of December, so it was this past week. And it says, Tennessee police officer involved in cop gone wild sex scandal where female officer had affairs with at least seven others. This headline is so poorly written. Let me start again. Tennessee police officer involved in cop gone wild sex scandal where female officer had affairs with at least seven others sues city and claims he was terminated and defamed because he's black. So the thing is, there's this female officer who had affairs with at least seven other officers. This is in Tennessee. And the theme of betrayal is right there. I think she's married, if I'm not mistaken, but they're talking about affairs. So clearly either she was married or the officers were married or both. And an affair is basically a very kind of primal example of betrayal, as you can imagine. When you have an affair, you're betraying your spouse. So this woman was having affairs with at least seven other officers. So the theme of betrayal in Tennessee, what a coincidence. You know, strange things happen all the time, you know, but the fact that this story came out as we've been talking about Tennessee and betrayal, I know it's not a coincidence. And then one of the officers involved in this scandal is now suing the city. And we've been talking about all this lawsuits, these frivolous lawsuits, and we'll be talking about that later, you know, where people are complaining that my feelings have been hurt, and therefore you have to give me $100 million, that sort of thing. And now this police officer is suing the city, claiming that he was terminated and defamed because he's black. But because apparently the other officers who were involved in the scandal were white, and they were not prosecuted, they were not terminated, or, you know, like things were, he was treated more harshly than the other guys, and that's why he's suing. And here it says he's claiming $3 million in damages, as well as front and back pay. So, you know, after having been in an affair, in a scandal that has tarnished his police department, now he's saying my feelings have been hurt and I want $3 million. And as we've said before, where did this money amount come from? And we've had this ambiguity, which is just like one of the many examples of the ambiguity in our entire system, including the judiciary system. And we've never really made any effort to pin down the parameters for it, you know, what the amount should be and what circumstances. It's just these arbitrary numbers that people pull out of their buttocks. And the other force behind that, that arbitrary nature of those numbers, is that they are motivated by an army of jackals and thieves called the lawyer profession in America, and because they want a cut of the money. And we have this legal profession that is has turned into this money changer merchant enterprise. When lawyers who are dealing with law should never profit from law. They deserve a decent wage just like any other person, but it should always be a fixed wage. And we've said this a million times. In the new American Constitution, that would have been one of the fundamental principles that would have been embedded there. And it's related to the third pillar that we talked about a long time ago. And it's this idea that the lawyers should be paid in a fixed wage. It would be constitutionally written in, like, they can only make up to 1.5 times the national average. And they don't get paid a percentage of what they win in a lawsuit, nothing like that. And there would have been a lot of other radical changes to the legal profession. And I think we did talk about some of those things, but maybe we didn't talk about all the things. We never got to that, I guess. But I think we did say some other things, not just the salary cap. But the thing is, you can't have the problem with the legal profession, why it's different from other professions, is that it deals with the law. And the law, you cannot have people who manipulate the law profiting from it, because it's a perfect recipe for corruption. You're going to be motivated to manipulate the laws to profit. And that's why, you know, most of the people in Washington are lawyers. And it makes sense, you know, the lawyer profession leads you into the world of politics. It's just natural. So you can't have a political class of people, political group of people who have this lawyer mentality where they say, okay, if I manipulate the law, I can make it more profitable for us and my fellow lawyer colleagues. You can't have that motivation. You have to strip it out. And that's why the lawyer profession is different and has to be capped. In terms of salary, and no one. So if I'm fighting for my client, and I'm trying to get $100 million for him for some, who knows, some weird reason, I should be doing it out of principle. That, yeah, that person deserves $100 million, not because I'm going to get $30 million from that. Oh, and by the way, there would have been a kind of a transition period, like a decompressing period, as that transition is changed, because you have to take into account that a lot of people go to the legal profession expecting to make a lot of money, and because they expect to make a lot of money, they go through, I don't know exactly how many years, 12 or who knows how many years of university study, very expensive, to get to the point where they can then start making a lot of money off of the profession. So it would be unfair to a certain extent to those people who have made the investment to then be told you're not going to make more than a certain amount. So there would have been a decompression period over several years, so that eventually the reality could catch up, or the expectations could catch up with the reality of the salary cap, if I'm making any sense. But eventually we would have gone into a period where lawyers would have, and then you put a salary cap on the profession, you change the people who want to go into it, and you change the mindset. So people who go into the legal profession will become much more monk-like, more monastic, more like, I'm doing this out of principle, I'm not here for the money, I'm doing it because I enjoy thinking about law and justice and judgments, things like that. It would have changed the whole nature, and then that would have been the pull from which politicians would have started coming up through the system. But I digress. So the thing is that I was digressing, but it's all related, because as we will see later. So that was one story. I'm not going to go into the sordid details here about the betrayals and the affairs here in the Tennessee Police Department. But and by the way, I'm looking at the officers who were apparently involved in this thing. There are 6 images of them. There were 3 whites, 1 Hispanic, and 2 blacks. Apparently the 2 black officers were both fired And the others, even the Hispanic, were, well, yeah, he was fired too. So, so there's a lot of firing going on. So this guy alleging that he was the one, targeted especially, you know, he's just trying to make money off of his infidelity, which is despicable. So he's adding to his, judgment to his, betrayal. So that's one story that came out. And I know that's not a coincidence, as we've been talking about Tennessee and Ohio and betrayal. The other story, also on the Daily Mail, posted on December the 18th. It says 9-month-old boy is orphaned when his mom and dad, Jacob Hahn and Savannah Harding, are killed by a woman who rear-ended their car at high speed. So it says Jacob Hahn, 24, and Savannah Harding, 22, were pronounced dead at the scene after a drunk driver struck their car on an Ohio road. The driver, 55-year-old Samantha Hammonds, was charged with 2 counts of aggravated vehicular manslaughter. The young couple leaves behind their infant son, Beckett Wayne. So it says a 9-month-old boy was left orphaned after his parents were killed by a speeding drunk driver who slammed into their car on an Ohio road. So it says here that happened on December 9th, and it was a 55-year-old Samantha Hammonds who was speeding down the Fremont Pike when she rear-ended the young couple's car, causing it to spin into the eastbound lane where it was struck by another driver. I don't know exactly how this fits in, but I felt the need to mention it. These people were rear. It felt connected because this couple, usually it's a head-on collision or something like that. But this in this case, or side impact, like somebody like a drunk driver. Busting through a red light and hitting a car, you know, going perpendicular to the drunk driver. But in this case, this couple was rear-ended. And that makes you think, oh, rear-ended. Where do you get stabbed when you're betrayed? It's not in the front. It's in the back, usually. You know, that's the expression. You know, oh, that guy stabbed me in the back. That means he betrayed me. So this woman came from behind to this unsuspecting couple and rear-ended them. And because she rear-ended them, they spun and went into the eastbound, you know, the opposite lane, and a car came head-on and hit them and killed them. But it was a symbolic manifestation of a betrayal because they were hit from behind by this woman. And I don't know, it's just such a strange story that came out, and the fact that it was, you know, from Ohio. I don't know. I know it's related to the issue of betrayal, and then sadly, you know, they have this little boy that I'm seeing here in the pictures, and now he's an orphan because of that rear-ended incident. And I know that's a confirmation of that betrayal. And I'm seeing a picture of them, the couple that died, and I don't know why they're standing somewhere, maybe on the street or a mall, I'm not quite sure. And behind them, there's a guy wearing a Cleveland Browns t-shirt, talking in the backgrounds. Maybe they were at a game or something, but I find that, I know it's not a coincidence. So those two stories confirm this connection between Tennessee, Ohio, and betrayal, how betrayal is in the air. These other three stories that we'll want to go through are somehow related. This one might seem like, oh, that has nothing to do with betrayal, but I feel like it does, so I'm just going to say it. This was posted on the 21st of December on the dailymail.co.uk site again. And the headline reads, "Moment very unlikely porch pirate in Nashville steals family's package after dancing around Amazon delivery driver." So you read the headline, you go, what? What are they talking about? So it says, Marlene O'Mara was shocked to find her daughter and granddaughter's Xmas gifts had, or Saturnalia gifts. It says Christmas, but let's call it what it is. Granddaughter's Saturnalia gifts had disappeared from her front porch. When she checked security footage, she found the thief was none other than her neighbor's Siberian Husky. She was able to retrieve the package from the dog's owner, saying, "I was mad at first, but I laugh every time I watch the video." So this Nashville woman, Nashville is in Tennessee, and her surname is O'Mara. And I don't know, I didn't research it, but I wouldn't be, I don't think I need to be an expert on surnames to conclude that O'Mara is an Irish surname. I could be wrong, but I don't think so, because it's spelled O apostrophe Mara, so it has to be Irish. So again, the theme of betrayal and all that is there. And so it's a funny story. So apparently this Amazon delivery driver went and left a package in the front porch. And as he was leaving it, the dog from next door, the neighbor, came in and was, you know, kind of dancing around, being all, you know, playful with the Amazon delivery driver. And in the video, you see the Amazon driver leaving the package and heading to his, you know, delivery truck to you know, continue with his deliveries. And the dog watches him as he gets into the car, into his truck. And as he's leaving, it's like he said, okay, now it's, the coast is clear. And he goes towards the package and grabs it and takes it and starts chewing on it and takes it with him, you know, next door to where he lives, the neighbor's house. You'd say, well, that's, you know, that's a sneaky betrayal. That's the same mindset. You know, he's all playful with the delivery driver. Like, he's like just a playful little dog. And then he waits for the driver leaves. And then once he knows that the driver is leaving, he turns around and takes the package as if to say, this is what I was really here for. I was pretending to be a nice dog, but I'm actually here for the package to steal it. And I know it's a dog. And it's not like the dog is thinking. But the dog is like a reflection of what's in the air. Because dogs can tend to, you know, animals tend to kind of absorb what's in the air and manifest it. And they kind of take the attitude, the mindset of their owners sometimes, and they channel it. And that's what this dog was doing. So, you know, what was this neighbor's dog doing just, you know, running around free in the neighborhood? So there's something going on, like he's out of control. Then apparently the package was recovered. So he chewed on the packaging, exterior packaging, but the gift or whatever that was inside of it was not damaged. So there's something there, like, there's this woman, in Ohio that killed someone because she was drunk. And that has to do with the server personality being distorted. Too long to explain, but that's more or less that. And the server personality is like a dog. So here we go again with a dog, the server personality playing a role in some backhanded action. Literally, you know, the rear-ended driver, and then this dog kind of dancing around like, oh, I'm a nice dog and everything. And then the driver leaves and says, okay, now to do what I was really here for. And he took the package and stole it. So it's like the component, the server personality is very relevant in the action of betrayal. Just like Benedict Arnold, he wanted to please, the server wants to please, dogs want to please. the server wanted to please his wife. Benedict Arnold loved his wife, wanted to please her. And as he began to want to please her, then that betrayal entered his heart. And Arnold, you know, backstabbed America. So that just illustrates that connection between the server personality, that desire to please, and that's how you end up compromising your principles, and that's how you become a traitor. That's what happened, for example, to Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan had a very big calling on him. He had a call to greatness, and he's a politician here in America, and a Republican politician. And I knew that he had a calling to eventually become president of the United States and be a great, great president. I saw it in him. But something happened to him as he was, you would hear him speak, and it was like inspiring. Back in the early 2000s, late 2000s and early 2010s, I remember hearing him talk, and I go, wow, that guy has something on him, very special. But as he got immersed in the world of Washington and everything, something got into him that he needed to please people. And that desire to please and be liked, because dogs want to be liked, servers want to be liked. The server personality just desires to be liked. And the desire to be liked is so strong that they eventually become traitors, because it's like they have to choose my communion with the people that I want to please and be around, or my principles. And eventually they go, okay, I choose the people I want to be with, that I want to please and be pleased by. And that's how they end up compromising. And now this Paul Ryan sounds like an Irish surname. He became this turncoat, worthless son of a bitch traitor. And now he's the complete opposite of everything he stood for when he started in politics. Now let's continue with another story that seems related to this whole theme of Tennessee, Ohio, and betrayal. I'm going to click on it very quickly. Again, I'm not sure why it's relevant exactly, but I know it's relevant. I feel it. It's relevant. So I'm just going to read it quickly here. Again, dailymail.com, posted on the 16th of December, 2023. So all of these stories are from this past week, and I know it's not a coincidence. You know, there's all of this stuff about Tennessee, Ohio, and Ireland in some way. In this case, it's Ireland. It says, a portrait of the artist as a British man. Diplomatic struggle simmers over French plaque suggesting Irish writer James Joyce was from the UK. Ironically, the Irish Cultural Center in Paris is just 300 meters from the address. So, it says here, he's probably Ireland's most famous cultural export, but a plaque outside a house where James Joyce lived in Paris has raised hackles for years by describing him as a British writer. Now, it's interesting. It says here, this has raised hackles for years. So this is not something that happened yesterday. But for some reason, the Daily Mail felt the need to report on this past week. And I know it's not a coincidence. I know these people at the Daily Mail and these other places sometimes feel a stirring to do something. Let me write about this story. And they don't know why they're doing it. Maybe they need to fill space on their webpage. But regardless, they something calls them to write about these things, and they write about them. It's not a coincidence. So it says here, now the Irish Mail on Sunday has learned the Irish embassy in Paris has contacted the authorities there with a view to having the wording on the plaque changed. Although Joyce famously lived at many addresses in Dublin, Paris, Trieste, Zurich, and beyond, the apartment at 71 Rue du Cardinal Lemoyne, in the city's Latin Quarter, is regarded as especially important, as it is where he wrote a large part of his masterpiece, Ulysses. I was forced to read Ulysses at university. I remember almost nothing from it. I used to read those books just because I was forced to, and had to pass the course. But so many books, even from Charles Dickens and all the, I read Tale of Two Cities. And you asked me what the story was, and I barely know. I know it's a tale about two cities, London and Paris, I think it was. I mean, that's how unsure I am. I passed the course, but I don't know why they would go in one eye and out the other, all the words. So same with Ulysses. So I read that book. It's apparently a masterpiece, according to this, but I wouldn't know because I don't remember. So the thing is, it says here, the plaque reads, quote, James Joyce, British writer of Irish descent, welcomed by Valerie Larbaud, a famous French writer, completed his novel Ulysses here, a major work of 20th century literature, unquote. Ironically, the Irish Cultural Center in Paris is just 300 meters from the address. So the controversy is that the plaque says James Joyce, British writer of Irish descent. I'm looking at the plaque, but is it in French? It says James Joyce, excuse me, 1882 through 1941, écrivain britannique. D'origine irlandais, and then I can't read the rest, but I wouldn't know how to pronounce it. But it says écrivain britannique. Écrivain, it makes me think of, excuse me, writer. Scripture, like scripture is writing. Écrivain sounds like writer. Britannique. And the reason why I'm trying to say it in French is that I don't know why, when I read it in French, it didn't offend me at all. Because outside of the UK, Britain is, it's like, you think of Britain, you think of the British Isles and the UK. And at the time when this plaque was written, Ireland was part of the British Empire. You know, because Ireland became independent in 1922 or sometime around that. So it makes sense that at that time, Ireland was part of the British Empire. And that's why it makes sense to call him a British writer. Because that's, from outside, it's like the term United Kingdom. Let me put it this way, in the Latin world, like in Spain, someone could correct me, but I'm 97% certain about this. Outside of the UK, especially in the Latin world, and when I mean Latin, I mean the Latin European countries like Spain, Italy, Portugal, they never say United Kingdom. It's too long. I don't know why it's just, it's not known as the United Kingdom. The UK is not known as the United Kingdom. It's always known as Great Britain, like in Spanish, Gran Bretaña. They don't say Reino Unido. That's how you would say United Kingdom in Spanish. But they don't say that for some reason. It seems like a strange wording. So they always say Great Britain everywhere. From outside the UK, it makes perfect sense to call James Joyce a British writer because he is inside the British Empire, Great Britain. So that's how you call him. You don't say United Kingdom writer. You don't say that in French. Your French is very Latin too. French is France is a mixture of the Latin peoples and the Germanic people combined, and a little bit of Celtic. France is a kind of combination of two or three racial groups in Europe, but it's very Latin. The language is very Latin. The grammar structure is very similar to Spanish and Italian, and so forth. So the thing is that it makes perfect sense, but now there has become a controversy that he is, you know, he's being called British, but he's really Irish, and the Irish resent that. And I don't know why this is related, but the fact that it came out, and this controversy, which side is he on? He's being portrayed as British, but he's really Irish, and how dare you, it's like an act of treachery, because the Irish resent being called British, and so forth. I'm still not trying to wrap my head around this, but I know it's related to this concept of betrayal, and which side are you on? And I'm sure that the Irish people feel betrayed by the French, because they assigned James Joyce a name a British name. Tag that he should not have according to them. But aside from that, I don't know why I had to mention this, but I know it is relevant. But it goes to the whole thing of Irish and which side are you on and so forth. Another story that we wanted to mention, which I still also do not understand the meaning of, is Tennessee was hit by this tornado. I think that's part of what we talked about in the last recording. But one thing I didn't mention in the last recording, especially because I didn't understand its relevance, was this story. So I'm going to read this from thegatewaypundit.com, posted on the 17th of December, 2023. And it says, "Miracle in Tennessee. 4-month-old baby found alive in tree after being swept up by tornado." It says, "In an almost biblical tale of survival, a 4-month-old infant was miraculously found alive in a tree after a devastating tornado tore through Clarksville, Tennessee, lifting the baby and its bassinet into its ferocious grasp. The Moore family's mobile home was unfortunately situated directly in the path of the devastating tornado on December 9th, which ruthlessly tore apart the structure, dispersing fragments of their belongings throughout the surrounding area. The baby, identified as Lord," which is kind of a peculiar name, Lord, L-O-R-D, like, you know, the Lord. "The baby, identified as Lord, and his one-year-old brother, Princeton, were at home with their parents, Sydney Moore, and her boyfriend, Aramis Youngblood, when the tornado hit. Sydney Moore, 22, recounted how the roof of their mobile home was ripped off as the tornado approached. The tornado's force was so strong that it lifted the bassinet with the baby inside. Aramis Youngblood attempted to grab the bassinet as it was being sucked up, and both he and the baby were thrown into the air. Sydney Moore, meanwhile, protected their older child, Princeton, from the collapsing walls. For about 10 minutes after the tornado passed, the baby was missing, sparking fear and desperation in the parents. In an incredible turn of events, the baby was found alive, lying in a fallen tree with only minor injuries, a cut on the side of his face that needed to be glued shut. The father, Youngblood, suffered a broken arm and shoulder during the ordeal. The family described their survival and the baby's miraculous discovery as an act of divine intervention, stating that it was, quote, by the grace of God, unquote, that they found their child alive and mostly unharmed. The family lost everything in the tornado and is now seeking a new home. And the local community has rallied around them, providing essential supplies like diapers and formula. A GoFundMe page has been set up to assist the family in rebuilding their lives." So, And they show a picture of where the baby was found, and he wasn't found like on the ground. He was found in the middle of a tree trunk, like halfway, or maybe not halfway up, but kind of above ground. It's like the bassinet he was on got stuck on a branch, maybe I would dare say 2-3 meters above ground. So he was hanging on the tree. I don't know how to explain it. It's not like he was dropped on the ground gently. He was left hanging on the tree. But he was safe, thankfully. And it makes me think of, you know, the potential for the great things that could have happened if the betrayal had been overcome. Because there was this big judgment on Tennessee that just happened with this tornado. And I think what happened also is that the mother was willing to sacrifice herself for the kid. As we were reading the story, she kind of like threw herself on the baby to protect them on one of the babies, because they had two children. But the thing is that she had the willingness to sacrifice herself for her child. And I don't know if I saw this story somewhere or this comment somewhere where she said something about she was willing to die for him. I'm not sure if I can locate it now, but I do remember reading that she said something about being willing to die for the kid, for her children, and that attitude of sacrifice, that visionary attitude, the visionary is willing to sacrifice for the future, and the babies are the future, and she was willing to give her life and sacrifice for them, and I think that was what allowed this kid to survive, and if instead of the betrayal, we had been willing to sacrifice ourselves, then the future would have been rescued. And to me, it's like this is more not a promise of what will happen. It's a tale of what could have been, and that's how I see it. And it happened in Tennessee. And Tennessee, by the way, I'm just going to say this very quickly, is I think we've mentioned this on the website where these recordings are posted. Tennessee is the birthplace of a movement that is called the Latter Rain Movement in America. That's where it all started in Tennessee, which is so ironic because the Latter Rain Movement has many concepts in it, and it has many concepts that would have been essential to the restoration of this country. So it's sad that the birthplace of this movement is in a state that eventually became a state of betrayal. And I know that's symbolic, it's as if there was something great in America with great ideas and great potential that could have survived and thrived, but that potential was betrayed by the very people around the promise, if I'm making any sense. It's like the promise was born in Tennessee, and the people in Tennessee, instead of embracing the promise and giving themselves in sacrifice for the promise, they betrayed it. They sold out that beautiful thing that was being born out of Tennessee, and that's why America died. And it's that, like, this story is like the counterexample, and I also see it as a figure of how the promise that was of greatness, of the great things that were for America, America betrayed all of that, but at least that's all of that's going to be taken somewhere else. It's as if this baby represented the promise of greatness for America being taken, literally taken up in the air and transported somewhere else. And I think that's what this story is about. And also the name of the baby, Lord. It's not a very common name to give to your kid. And they lost a lot of, they lost everything. They're also missing one of their cats, Baloo. He's gray. And that's sad to know that they lost one of the cats. Gray, it, to me, is always, not that gray is bad in and of itself, but when I think about it in a negative context, I think of ambiguity, like people who don't decide, you know, they don't want to be black or white, they want to be gray, they want to be compromised in between. And I think that's what that little cat represents. I feel sorry for the cat. Who knows where it is? Maybe it's meowing somewhere. Maybe it's making friends with the dog that stole the Amazon package. Who knows? But I know all of this is not a coincidence. So now that we've talked about that, we wanted to. Oh, our time is really gotten short now. We'll try to go through these quickly. And we wanted to get to the heart of the matter here. So again, this is all related to the theme of betrayal. This story came out this week. Let me just pull up. Yes, this is the one. This was posted on December 17th on thegatewaypundit.com. And the headline reads, "Crane moved into Arlington Cemetery for removal and destruction of Civil War Reconciliation Memorial this week." So there's this memorial that has like a woman at the top. It's like a statue with the pedestal and soldiers in the pedestal, you know, on the sides of the pedestal. And it's pretty big. I'm looking at the people standing below it, you know, at the base. And yeah, it's huge. So this article is about the outrage the conservatives feel about the removal of the statues. Because, you know, as we've said before, conservatives get outraged when the liberals go around tearing down Confederate statues. Jefferson Davis and all these people, and they keep tearing them down, and the conservatives go, "Oh, that's part of our history." And I always say to myself, "Oh yeah, it's like the Germans saying, oh, don't tear down that statue of Hitler or I'm trying to think of the name Goebbels or Gerbil or I forget one of those nasty generals." And you know, it's like the Germans saying, "Oh, don't tear that statue down." I'm trying to remember the name of the Nazi guys, but I don't know why they're not coming to me. Mengele. There's a statue of Mengele, and the Germans say, "Hey, don't tear down the statue of Mengele. Oh, he was evil. Oh, we don't care. It's part of our history." You know, that's how stupid that sounds. But conservatives are stupid. They are trapped in a mindset. They just don't get it. Now, this one, you would think maybe it's not as controversial as the statue of Jefferson Davis. You know, Jefferson Davis with the son of a bitch who's burning in hell as we speak, who was the, quote, president of the Confederate country when it was around during the Civil War. So it says here, maybe it doesn't say it with as much detail here, but let me put it. Yeah, it says here, Congress voted to remove the statue earlier this year. 41 Republicans joined Democrats. And they put it like, oh, traitors. Like, they highlight it in such a way that it makes it sound like these Republicans are traitors because they joined the Democrats. To move forward with the destruction of this statue, the demolition was scheduled for no later than January 1st, 2024. Millions of U.S. dollars are being allocated to dismantle the memorial dedicated to Civil War veterans. The statue was dedicated by President Calvin Coolidge in 1924. It says here, there's a tweet that's shown here. It says, in 1924, President Calvin Coolidge, a Vermonter and Northerner, placed a wreath on the newly dedicated Confederate Reconciliation Memorial at Arlington Cemetery, which will soon be destroyed by the Department of Defense. Our ruling class today believes in desecration, not reconciliation. Sad. And I go, what? So these conservatives are outraged. They see this as, oh, this was a statue of reconciliation. But you have to, these morons don't understand the history. But let's go back to the 1920s. Most people don't know this. And I don't think even these conservatives know this. Or if they know it, they kind of know it in a distorted way. In 1924, Calvin Coolidge was the president. How did that happen? Warren G. Harding, who was from Ohio, by the way, he was the Republican president, and he was a foreshadowing of Obastor. We mentioned that this on the website where these recordings are posted. Warren G. Harding was a foreshadowing of Obastor. The analogies are just, the parallels are so awe-inspiring. Like, you go, my goodness, this is Obastor foreshadowed. But the thing is, Warren G. Harding died in 1923 on the third year of his first term, or first and only term. And Calvin Coolidge, who was the vice president, took over. So, and then he won the election in 1924 and became president from 1924 on to 1928. And he left shortly, the year before the Great Depression and the stock market crash. His years are seen as by conservatives as the golden years of conservatism because he believed in less of fair government. He let people just do their thing. And he was very crucial or instrumental in the era of the Roaring Twenties, as they call them here in America, where the economy was booming and everybody was prospering and people were partying and dancing and doing their thing, and he's celebrated by conservatives as this paragon of conservatism. And yet, I believe in less of fair economics. And just to certify that, I used to read books from the Austrian school, from von Mises and Hayek, Friedrich Hayek, and so forth. So, and I at least accepted most, if not all. I rejected some things, but I believe in the principle of less of fair economics. You just let people be free and let the economy grow and stop with all this overbearing restrictions. So I'm not against laissez-faire economics, but the problem with Calvin Coolidge is that it gets to the point where he just said, oh, just let people do their thing. It's like he was just there letting people do their thing. And that can get negative, can become a bad thing. If you're not willing to fight against things that are wrong. During the 1920s, the Ku Klux Klan in America began to rise up, and that all started with Woodrow Wilson, the president who was there before Harding. Woodrow Wilson was a racist. He started allowing the Ku Klux Klan to rise in the South, and then the Republicans came on, Harding and then Coolidge, and they did nothing about it. Because, again, the Republicans lost their identity in 1876, as we described in detail in previous recordings. So the party that was born specifically to fight against the oppression of black people in America, again, betrayal, turned its back on black people in 1876 and sold black people down the river, literally and figuratively, to the Democrats in order to gain the election and gain power in 1876. Betrayal. So the Republican Party is a party of traitors. They've been a party of traitors since 1876. All these conservatives who get outraged when the Republicans betray them. My goodness, you morons, you don't realize the Republican Party betrayed its calling 100 years ago, more than 100 years ago. And you're complaining now you didn't get it? And the Republicans and the conservatives still don't get it. So in the 1920s, the Republicans took over, became and they had a prospering economy. It was like the perfect situation to say, okay, now we have the popularity, we have a booming economy, we have the control, the reins of government. Let's fight the oppression of black people in the South. And on top of that, they had, see, Warren G. Harding was half black or a quarter or an eighth black. He was the first and only black president we had, because Obastor was never a legitimate president, as we've said before. So Warren G. Harding, he had black blood in him, and he was a Republican. He had every opportunity to start, and he being one-eighth black, or one-fourth, I forget, it always was rumored, it was not official, but I know him at being, he was 1/8 black. I know he was 1/8 black. There's enough evidence to believe that. But the thing is that he had the opportunity to do something to help black people who were starting to get oppressed pretty badly in the South around that time, and he did nothing, or he did very little. And then Calvin Coolidge, who was a Northerner, so he didn't have the affiliation with the South, but no, he didn't do a diddly squat. Instead of doing something to mitigate or end what was beginning to happen, the rampant increased oppression of black people in the South, he I don't know if he was the one who appointed the building of this monument, or he was just there for the signing ceremony, but he was there, and he came with a wreath, and I see a picture of Calvin Coolidge, you know, putting a wreath there in front of the monument of reconciliation, like, oh, let's mend things. But you have to think about this. Reconciliation between what people? Between the whites in the South and the whites in the North. Who else is getting reconciliated here? Because it sure ain't the white people in the South with the black people in the South. There was there was absolutely no reconciliation going on there. On the contrary, the white people in the South were beginning an onslaught of oppression against black people. No reconciliation there. So who was getting reconciled here? The white people of the South with the white people of the North. That's what this was promoting. Let's end that bitterness between the states. How can you end the bitterness between the states, the North and the South, when the South was ramping up its oppression and doing what led to the war to begin with? See, you don't reconcile with people who are still doing the very thing you got into conflict for. You see what I'm saying? So this reconciliation is this statue, stupid statue, and Calvin Coolidge honoring the statue is exactly a representative of what the Republican Party did in 1876. They said, let's reconcile with the South. The white people of the South reconciling with the white people of the North so that we can all get along and be a country once again, and so that I, Rutherford B. Hayes, can be the president of the United States. And me and my Republican Party can be in control of the country. But it was at a compromise. So this statue is actually a monument, literally, to betrayal. It's a monument representing the betrayal of the Republican Party against black people and as a result, against America itself. And the liberals, you know, who, you know, they are just like crazy people, so they just go around tearing down stuff, and that thing has the name Confederacy in it, so they are wanting to tear it down, but we should be embracing this. It's like, awesome, you know, everybody should be embracing this and saying, hey, Republicans, you have to get back to what you were supposed to do, what you left, what you betrayed in 1876, you should get back to it and be a defender of black people in the right way, not in the way the Democrats do it, but in the right way. But the Republican Party became the other party in 1876 because the moment it lost its core principles and betrayed its principles, it just became the other party because it had no identity anymore. And that's what we've been living in for all this time. And no one gets it, not the conservatives. And the conservatives are defending this. This is like part of our history. It's part of our reconciliation. In the 1920s, there was no reconciliation going on. The black people in the South were being oppressed. What the hell are you talking about, reconciliation? Are you saying, okay, let's reconcile. In other words, let's accept what the white people in the South are doing to black people. Let's accept the rise of the KKK and the lynchings and all this voter suppression that was going on in the South because we need to reconcile. That's what a traitor does. A traitor overlooks all these glaring problems because he's more concerned about being liked and having a repartee with the other people than in standing up for principle. So Calvin Coolidge could have stood up for principle as a Northerner. As far north as you can get, Vermont is way up there in the north of the country. That's almost, the only way you could get further north was having been born in Maine. And so he saw as far away from the South as, you know, culturally and historically in his life as you could get. And instead of saying, we're going to stand up for the principles of the Republican Party, the party of the defense of Black people, we're going to stand up for that, and we are not going to reconcile with the South until the South stops oppressing Black people. But no, oh, let's reconcile, and let's have this monument. Because what he wanted was a country in peace so that we could all prosper and make a lot of money. And the truth said, the hell with you all. And then in 1929, the stock market crashed. And boom, all that prosperity went down to hell. And then what happened? Son of a bitch, polio boy, FDR took over. And then we've been on the way, on the road to destruction ever since. So this monument is actually an eyesore to the truth and to anyone who understands what was happening in those years. I go, my goodness, do these people know? Do these people understand history? I don't know how to explain my frustration. But the country's dead, so what else can you expect? So we wanted to mention that. And, okay, so, and so that was the story. And, but, a story that came out shortly before that one, which is related, so the story I read was, you know, with the crane coming and the crane moved in, into Arlington Cemetery on December 17th, the story was posted. Then the next day on the gatewaypundit.com, on December 18th, this was posted. Headline, just in, : Trump appointed judge halts removal of Confederate memorial at Arlington Cemetery. So there was a Trump-appointed judge, so it's some judge that Trump put in when he was in the White House, a federal judge, and the judge issued what they call a temporary restraining order to halt the removal of the Confederate memorial. And the thing is, the person writing this article, she's calling it the Confederate Memorial. Just when you think about it, that it's like saying the Nazi Memorial. Oh, the Confederates were not like the Nazis. Yes, they were. Same principle. I'm sorry. Maybe the scale of it was different, but it's the same principle. The Confederate movement was a movement born out of hatred towards a certain race, and saying, you're not going to tell us that we don't have the right to oppress this race of people. The Nazis were born out of this hatred. We are going to exterminate this race, and you're not going to do anything to stop us. Same principle. It's just variation of the degree, but it's the same hatred. So they recognize, even these conservatives writing these articles, they recognize this is a memorial to the Confederates, to the people who betrayed, an act of treason. We always knew that the South, when they broke off, it was an act of treason. And it's even written in the 14th or 15th Amendment, they're called traitors, people who betrayed the nation. So the theme of treachery, you know, a betrayal is in the air. That's the topic. And so the South betrayed, did an act of treachery, and then we went to war against them and defeated the hell out of them. And now we're talking about a memorial to honor their betrayal. It's a Confederate memorial. No, it's a memorial not to the betrayal, it's to the reconciliation after the betrayal. In other words, to reconcile with the people who betrayed us, who are still doing the same betrayal, even as we're raising up the monument. Because in the 1920s, as we said, the racism in the South was stirring pretty badly. Because Calvin Coolidge and Warren G. Harding were the do-nothing people. It's like, okay, do your thing. And the South, their thing was to oppress Black people at the time. So they did their thing. So there was no reconciliation going on. You were reconciling with the traitors who are still in their treachery. But the Trump judge, and it's interesting that it was a Trump-appointed judge, because, as we said a moment ago, Trump is a traitor. And just to give you a quick sign, and I know this recording has run very long, but we'll say these two, and we had more things to say, but we'll have to say them some other time in the next recording, if the truth allows it. But let me say these, read this headline very quickly. Speaking of Trump, posted on the dailymail.co.uk or dailymail.com. It was posted on the 20th of December, 2023. And it reads, the headline, Trump again says immigrants are, quote, poisoning the blood of our country, unquote, as he denies reading Hitler's Mein Kampf despite using language by dictator in recent speeches. Now, this is not a coincidence. And I was just saying, and I didn't realize the connection until just this moment. We were talking about the Nazis over and over again a moment ago, and he is now in the controversy over having quoted something from Hitler's Mein Kampf. And I don't think he got it from Mein Kampf, and I'll tell you where he got it from. He got it from what's in the air. See, every time conservatives defend the Confederates, and I don't know why they would do that, but they do that over and over again. Whenever, every time they defend the memorial, and it's not the conservatives are racist, it's just the conservatives are idiots. That's why they do it. That's not because they're racist, it's because they're idiots, because they don't see the relevance of that, because it would force them to think many things they don't want to go. It's like they don't want to go there. So they shut the door. It's like, you don't open this door is locked. We don't go into that room. We don't talk about what's behind that door. That's how they think. So that's why they start, when you do those things in your life, you start doing very stupid things. When you close doors and say, I'm not going to go there because I don't want to think of the consequences of what's behind that door. Where the logical consequences that I will be led to by thinking about what's behind the door. When you do that, you start believing a lot of stupid things. So that's what conservatives do. So that's in the air. Conservatives defending the Confederacy. And as they defend the Confederacy, they are stirring into the air the defense of Nazism. And as they're stirring that's what's in the air. And that's what this is. And Trump in his antennae caught that message. But I'm going to tell you where he got this from. And I could be wrong, but I don't think so. But maybe what I'm saying is not exactly right. But it, I believe it's more or less right. Maybe the name that I'm about to say is not the exact name, but I would say that you just have to replace what I said, one name with another similar name, and you'll get the exact answer. But I think this is exactly what happened. He must have been talking to Jared and Ivanka, because Jared and Ivanka have been traveling to Israel and acting like they're defending Israel. And Jared, you know, Abraham Accords and all that stuff that we've talked about before. So he's doing his thing. And it's a useless trip. And I'm pretty sure that Jared and Ivanka must have been on a phone call with Trump. And Jared must have, Ivanka said, Daddy, Jared has something to say to you. Okay, so she passed the phone to Jared and said, Trump, what's up? And everything fine, and I'm being sued here and there, blah, blah, blah. So they started chatting a bit. And then Jared said, yeah, I've been hearing about all this immigration stuff that's been going on, you know, all these illegals that are coming through the country. Yeah, I know. So Trump said, yes, I know. It's pretty bad. And then Jared said, yeah, it's a shame because these people are poisoning the blood of our country, aren't they? Yeah, you're right. I hadn't seen it that way. I'm going to use that one. Thanks, Jared. And then once he got that word in, Jared said, okay, I gotta run. I don't know if he calls him dad or whatever. Father-in-law, I've got to go, or I can pass the phone back to Ivanka and talk to you later. Bye. And that's how he got that phrase into his head, because the Democrats must have told Jared, we need something special now. So you've been our weapon of choice for injecting ideas into Trump. So we want you to inject this phrase into his head, poisoning the blood of our, because we just read it from Mein Kampf, because we bought the book, because we wanted to see if we could plant something in Trump's head. That's how he got it into his head, and then that's how he said it. And Trump, being the idiot that he is, he just blurted it out because he opens his ears to traitors, and that's that's how he got that. And because he's a traitor himself, he's willing to betray his principles because he's more loyal to the art of the deal than to his principles. If he had to choose between staying faithful to what he promised and staying faithful to his book, The Art of the Deal, he's going to be faithful to that, and he's going to betray the other thing. So it's not a coincidence that a Trump-appointed judge was the one trying to stop the Confederate thing, removal of the Confederate statue. And then this is the last thing, and I know this recording has run forever, but this is the last thing. And I'm going to I'm going to read from this article on thegatewaypundit.com, posted on December 19th, 2023. And I'm going to read this, and remember, this is being written by a stupid conservative, so you have to read it with a grain of salt in your eye. It says, Ron DeSantis takes a swipe at Trump and MAGA on MSNBC. It says Trump could have pardoned all January 6thers and calls MAGA, quote, his people. So it says, Governor Ron DeSantis, who continues to slide in the national polls, so a little jab, you know, who continues to slide in the national polls, took a swipe. Again, this is, you know, very, took a swipe at Trump. Instead of just saying what he said, you know, adding all this commentary in between, took a swipe at Trump and MAGA movement during his interview on MSNBC. DeSantis insisted Trump could have pardoned all of the January 6thers before he left office. How was President Trump supposed to have to know that the DOJ and FBI was going to arrest over 1,200 Trump supporters, including hundreds who walked inside the open doors on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th? You know how he could have known? If he had had his eyes wide open, if he had realized what was going on. These people were arrested immediately, and then a lot of people began to get arrested over time. But DeSantis has a point. And we've said this over and over again. If I had been Trump after January 6th and after having been driven out of the White House, I would have been in the Capitol building or in front of the jail every day protesting for all the people that are inside the prison, you know, where the January 6th people are kept. And I would have demanded to see them. And I would have been willing to get arrested if needed and join them in jail to fight for them, just like they tried to fight for him. But he's a traitor. He doesn't think that way. The traitor is the opposite of someone who sacrifices himself for other people. That's what makes them a traitor. They sell out. And you could argue, well, maybe, I think it's mentioned here somewhere that that DeSantis, I think he said, I could be wrong with this, but I think somewhere in here it says that DeSantis said he must have shied away from pardoning the January 6th people. Because here in America, we have this stupid idea that I'm against, but as long as the system is broken and it can be done, I'm for it. When done right, and it's the thing that presidents can pardon someone willy-nilly, you know, just say, I pardon you. And I think it's in the Constitution or somewhere that presidents have that power, and it's such a stupid thing, because why can a president arbitrarily say, you are forgiven, you've been put in jail, you've been tried by a jury of your peers, you're in jail for something, and I can just say, no, it's okay, you're free to go. Why? I don't know. And there's no limit to how many people you can pardon. It's crazy. Or maybe there is a limit, but it's a high number. The thing is that he could have pardoned the January 6th people, but let's say that and Trump said maybe he didn't do it because he was concerned that he would then be seen as a part of the insurrection, and he wanted to cover his backside, and said, no, I'm not going to go there, and that's why he didn't pardon them. Well, who must have given him that advice? He went to Jared, just like the television commercial here in America. He went to Jared. And Jared must have told him, don't do that, because then you're going to be seen as the leader of this insurrection, and then you're going to be tried for impeachment, because he was being impeached, or there was a threat of impeachment at the time against him. So he went the political route instead of fighting on principle. But let's say that you think it was not a good idea, and let's assume for the sake of argument that you're right. Then I would bring up one more thing. Why didn't he pardon Julian Assange? Why didn't he pardon Julian Assange? He could have done it, and he didn't do it. He pardoned a whole bunch of rappers who had done some crime and drugs and stuff. He pardoned a whole bunch of people. He didn't pardon Julian Assange, who was just being a journalist, just doing his thing as a journalist. And he's been arrested for no crime that he's not been really tried. He's been like in jail for years and years and no trial, no nothing, and his human rights are being violated left and right. He could have opened the door for him to have a avenue of pardon here in America, and he didn't do it. So don't tell me that Trump is not a traitor. He did an implicit pardon of Hillary right off the bat on November 27th or before that, 2016, right after he got elected, he made it official. I am pardoning Hillary for all the crimes and corruptions that she did, and I'm not going to prosecute her. So don't tell me Trump is not a traitor. So traitor, the spirit of betrayal, it's just embedded in the conservative movement. It's just you don't see it, but it's there. And that's why the country's dead, because the conservatives who are supposed to be the ones who wake up to the truth and would have helped to bring the revival and restoration of the country have betrayed the truth. Their betrayal is much more subtle than the one being done by the liberals, but it's there. And it's even worse than the liberals' betrayal, because it's much more subtle and much more deadly. But if they had been willing to listen to the truth, then what would have happened is similar to what happened with Houston beating the traitors of Tennessee. They would have allowed the truth seekers to rise up and defeat them. And just like that little baby that was rescued in Tennessee as well, there would have been hope and there would have been life. But no. Betrayal's in the air, and betrayal continues, and conservatives continue with their betrayal, and that's why the country is dead. But the truth is still saying, you have betrayed me. And even though the country's dead, it's important to say it over and over again. America has betrayed the truth, and that's why America is now dead. And I'm going to say this as a side note. I know this is way too long, but this is the last thing. I think it was yesterday. I had to go out, and it was a little dark, and I had the television on. The television is hooked up to this power strip, and I had the computer, it was off, but I had it plugged in to that power strip as well. And the computer is was connected through this adapter, or charger, or whatever you call it. And the charger, it has this like little rectangle that's like a little brick, and that rectangle has like an LED light, and it's green. And I'm looking at it as I'm saying all of this, and I had to go out, so I turned off the television by turning off the power strip. So I turn off the power strip because it has a switch in the power strip. So I turned it off, and that turns on the TV, and then I saw that. The light in the computer adapter, the charger, the green light stayed on. And I said, oh, that's weird. And I looked, and yeah, the power strip was off. So, and I've seen this before, the light stays green for a while. But I stayed there in the dark looking at it, and it just, and I think I literally stayed there for 30 seconds. Waiting for that light, that green light, to fade out and turn off, and it wouldn't turn off. And I said that was weird. So I went out and went to buy something and came back, and obviously And then I completely forgot about it. And then like an hour or so later, I looked at the adapter. When I came back, I was turning the power strip on, and then I saw that the adapter's light was off. And my point is, there was no more light, no more energy going into the adapter. Yet you looked, if you saw the adapter, you would think it was on, that was plugged into some energy, but it wasn't anymore. It was just the light, the remnants, the afterglow of the electricity that had gone through it. And it took a surprising amount of time for the light to fade out. That's the same with America. That's why a lot of people look and say, oh, things are going to come back to normal, and things are not as bad or whatever. But it's all just that afterglow. The country's already plugged out off the truth. The truth is not injecting life into this country anymore. This country's dead. So any life you see is just the afterglow. And I was thinking about that as I was walking on my lunch break by the pier here in Hoboken, New Jersey, right across Manhattan, right across the Hudson River from Manhattan. And I was looking at the buildings, and then a thought came to me. It's as if the truth said to me in a voice on the inside, those are pyramids. So I was looking at all the buildings, all the skyscrapers, and it looks like I'm in the first world, but I know I'm in the third world now. But it looks all modern and wealthy and all that. And it's as if the truth said, those are pyramids. And you know the pyramids in Egypt, huge things and all that, but they're dead. They represent a civilization that is dead. And these are all pyramids, and they will be seen as such as the years go by, because the country is dead, and the country's dead because it betrayed the truth. And that's the theme. That's what the truth wants to say over and over again. It's like resounding in the air. You betrayed me. You betrayed me. You betrayed me. Thank you very much for listening.